This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Whitten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And my co-host, Haley Malley.
That line you're worrying about crossing. Look behind you.
And Keir Hansen.
Gallifrey Public Radio. Now we have maths.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again. Welcome to episode 89 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we straighten our bow tie, slide across any surface regardless of friction, deem any object that we like as cool, and scream our defiance to the stars with carefully crafted speeches backed by a perfect score, while onlookers are moved to tears by the sheer grandeur of it all. I am Jay, and with me this week are Keir. How's it going, Keir?
Very good, sir. Yourself?
I'm doing great. And Haley, how are you doing tonight, ma'am?
Doing good.
Awesome. So tonight we're wrapping up our Doctor's introspective with the latest actor to complete his tenure, Matt Smith. With just 5 episodes fewer than David Tennant and the program reaching its highest popularity to date during his run, Smith has really become an undeniable face of the Doctor Who empire. There are millions of new fans to the program who consider Smith their Doctor, and even more who admitted to sadness seeing him go in the past season. But what exactly was it that about this relatively unknown talent that made the youngest actor to ever play the role such a resounding success? You know, tonight we're going to look very closely at a few episodes and quite a few additional scenes of note to try and find that out.
Yeah, it's interesting that you note that he's not only developed a huge following of fans who are newer to the program. Obviously, it's one of the things they want to do as a franchise is continue expanding the viewer base. And when that happens, as the saying goes, you never forget your first doctor. Mm-hmm. People latch on, they claim Smith as theirs. But there were just as many people who, after seeing how everything transpired towards the end of Name of the Doctor and things, that said, it's really sad to say goodbye to him. Tennant may be my doctor or whoever, Tom Baker may be my doctor or what have you, but they still thought that, it was a good run and they were sad to see him go.
Yeah. And I mean, Matt Smith leaving was the first regeneration that I had to deal with live. Like he was already the doctor when I started watching the show. So, even when I was like hitting the end of Tennant's run, I knew that Matt Smith was coming. Like I knew who it was even before I started with Eccleston. So this was the first one that I had to deal with, like the entire, holy crap, he's leaving the show. Who are they going to get to replace him? Oh, the last episode's coming, the whole range of it. And it was a bit brutal.
Yeah. The same for me.
So this is a new experience for a lot of people, not just people that came in with series 6, but for a lot of new people, because the show has really hit its stride in the last couple of years and really taken off in popularity. I'd say with series 6, basically when they started airing it the same day in America as they were in the UK, like that's really when things started to hit and people are like, oh, there's a show on, you can watch it and I can tell you exactly when it's going to be.
Yeah, that was just from a technical standpoint was something that they an enlightenment they should have had some while back. We still to this day question a lot of the things that BBCA does in terms of some of their decisions in light of what they choose to do back across the pond. But making sure that at least same day broadcast seemed common sense to us, but in a programmer's mind, who knows what goes into that. I'm sure that there was some politics involved or some other decisions that had to be factored in, but it definitely, when they made that call, it was a huge boon to the program itself, not just this program, but a number of others that were carried on both sides of the Atlantic through BBCA.
Right. And I mean, if you want to see a good example of that now, you look at Sherlock. It comes out in the UK months before we get it here in the States, and then we don't even get it on BBCA here. We get it on PBS, and you can't even find it by searching Sherlock on the DVR. You've got to look up Masterpiece Horror or something. It's a pain.
It's that little show that's on after that other thing with those people and the cravats.
Yeah. So, but I mean, that's the kind of thing prior to series six, that's the kind of thing you went through to find Doctor Who. You know, it was like, well, I know it starts in the UK in March, but I think we get it sometime in June. Oh, it started last week. Oh, well, crap. You know, that's the kind of thing you had to deal with. So them doing same day airings was a huge deal. And I really feel like that was the tipping point for the popularity of the show in the US. But the other part that factors into that, obviously, is the cast that they've got. And with Matt Smith being the youngest actor ever to play the role, it was a bit of a gamble on Stephen Moffat's part.
I think it's pretty clear as you go back and you watch now, you know, post Smith era, if you want to call it that, if we're now calling the end of that era or that tenure, and looking back, you can see that at least when he was strongly at the helm, Moffat had a very specific game plan of some points that he wanted to hit. You could tell right from the first episode that he was planting some seeds for some things that he wanted to incorporate in there. You know, some mentions of things like the silence, mentions of aspects that were going to come that told me and a number of other people that I've had this discussion with over the course of the past couple of years that he had a path that he was going to be taking the Doctor down, that he needed someone with the youth and the malleability that Matt Smith had. You know, he was a workable piece of clay in terms of, you know, human flesh, not funny. but he wanted someone that he could cultivate. And I think he definitely got that. I mean, there were signs early on that Smith had his chops, but you know, we even remarked as the seasons went by, you know, he'd hit these milestones and be like, okay, that's something new I've seen out of him. That's great. Now he's been given an opportunity to prove that he can do this. Now let's hope that they give him more of that material. Then he'd have, you know, he'd have to suffer through a loss. Oh, okay, great. Well, you know, with Moffat, there's not really a permanent loss. But anyway, but you know, he'd go through these really traumatic moments or the dark moments, and all the while Smith just kept stepping up and sort of, you know, unveiling another layer of what he was capable of. So, you know, whether that was something that they saw in early screen tests or whether it was just serendipity or luck, I know the Doctor doesn't believe in luck, but what have you. But I think Moffat made an excellent call on this.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you really do get that because he did get a full run. Like, you can look at Matt Smith's run and think, okay, he had an entire era to go with. You know, it's not like Paul McGann, who was, you know, one and done, and be like, oh man, I wish we'd gotten more. Christopher Eccleston, where, you know, we'd always wish for just one more season with him at least. And I feel like Matt Smith had a full run. You know, he had the 4 years, the entire time to really get into the role.
Mm.
So I don't know. I feel like he had a chance to fully actualize his Doctor, and it really did feel when he left, okay, this is the end of a chapter. It's not, you know, hitting the last page and being like, wait, what happened to the rest of the book? It felt like a natural point.
Yeah.
So,
but the first episode that we're taking a look at tonight was, well, the first episode. Keir picked the 11th hour, so.
Yeah, there were a couple of reasons for this. I mean, not just, you know, I'm not going to grab the first episode because it was the first opportunity for us to really kind of get to meet the man, but I think there were really some standout aspects that proved to us who were very concerned going into it. I mean, I know when this aired, at least here in the States, we sat down, there were like 8 of us packed around the living room, you know, and we just sat there, some scowling, waiting to see, you know, who dares replace David, you know, and that sort of thing. Other people just saying, okay, I'm gonna keep a carte blanche on this and let him prove himself to me. And others that just said, I don't understand what the show is about. Why did I get brought to this party? Well, there were a couple of those. But by the time it was all over, you could definitely tell that whether you were totally certain if Smith was going to make it as the Doctor or not, and there were very few that weren't at least certain that he would, that he had the groundwork necessary to really take that title role, you were definitely entertained. I mean, it was a well-written episode. It did a nice job of taking, as we've mentioned so many times, a completely new setup. You had a new production team that walked in the day RTD's crew walked off the set. They were literally handing equipment over to each other on their way through the doors You know, so no carryover companion. You're ditching the TARDIS interior for the vast majority of it. You destroy your screwdriver, you know, halfway through the episode. So that's gone. In fact, they make a gimmick out of it. I got no TARDIS, no screwdriver, 20 minutes, bam, you know, gets all these things done. What I thought was interesting to note, though, that in terms of production schedule, the first episode that Smith actually started filming with the rest of the crew was Victory of the Daleks. So, and we saw this in some of the previous instances of Doctors when they stepped in, that what we saw as their premiere appearance
was actually the second or third, yeah.
Yeah, so they get that little opportunity to work some of the kinks out, so to speak. Same for their companions in this case, you know, for Rory and Amy, who were getting their first introductions to as well. Mm. But I think in terms of being able to really show what Smith was going to bring to the character and what he was capable of doing, even from those early few episodes filmed, I was really impressed with the fact that he came at it, you know, full force. I mean, more energy than the screen could contain half the time. You know, it was frenetic, a bit chaotic.
Right. Time segments. Slightly.
Yeah, but I think that was called for. That was the way that they were going to play this one. Mm-hmm. This was one where he, as he said, he was not done cooking. And so as a result, you're going to get, you know, a lot of this, you know, herky-jerky response. Prove the physicality, because we knew, we could tell right away that he was going to be a very physical, very active doctor. A lot of running and sliding and jumping. And right from those early moments with young Amelia, I just thought it was really interesting to note that, you know, you got this 900-year-old Time Lord and a, what, 9-year-old? No.
12.
12, no, she was abandoned for 12 years.
Yeah, so 7?
She said she was 7, yeah.
7, yeah.
Right, okay, can we come back? Right, 12 years later. So, and the child is more stable than the adult. So she's standing there giving him, you know, those looks of consternation and things as he's spitting and throwing things all over the kitchen or explaining all of this bizarre stuff, or rambling at times when he's trying to find his balance between what he knows and what he's still trying to figure out. And he's just spewing dialogue and chewing scenery. And there's this little girl in a red housecoat who's just watching him spin around the room with an arched eyebrow. So I thought that was a great counterpoint.
Yeah, it really was just that great play between, it's like, okay, here's the adult and here's the child. Now let's reverse their roles. And, you know, you've got the doctor just having a blast with, you know, here, make me, you know, fry me something. You're Scottish. And, you know, it's just this great little interplay between them. And you do get to see, okay, that this doctor is not going to be your typical stodgy, okay, yes, let's do things my way. And he was going to be a lot more fun. Mm-hmm. And it, I mean, even this early on, they were setting up the companion is going to be what keeps him grounded, what keeps him from being the complete nut job that we know that he can be. And we're counting on this little girl to keep him in check.
Mm-hmm. And you could tell from the dialogue as well that, you know, one of the first things that they do when they sit down and they actually have an across the table kind of discussion is they're talking about family. Mm-hmm. Where's your mom and dad? They're gone. I just had my auntie. Where's she? She's out. You know, I don't even have an auntie. You know, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And they have this kind of family discussion from one of their first sit downs. So you talk about early establishment of theme, you know, it's a nice entry, and it takes some of the threat out of it all.
Yeah.
You know, this could potentially be a really troubling time for anyone involved, particularly the doctor, as he's trying to discover himself. But he's got this, he's got a project, a pet project to work on, this crack in the wall. You know, it's funny. And in all his time, when there's other things that he should be concerned with, it was an interesting little literary aspect for him to just take that, you know, 90-degree hard left and say, so that crack on the wall must be pretty scary, huh? Let's go look at it.
Yeah.
So it was a nicely penned episode as well. And I think it worked well for Smith because it allowed him to be able to say, I can do, you know, frantic. Sure. You want me to be all over the place at once? Got it.
Yeah, so this was just a great thing. I mean, you know, this is, I've said it before, this is a great first episode to show anyone. You know, just, you've heard about Doctor Who, but you've never watched it. Here, why don't you check this one out? It's the first one with this doctor. You know, it's a great place to jump in. And it, I mean, I've used this episode to introduce a lot of people, and it works really well. Mm-hmm. Because they get what they need to up front, but it's not as hokey as Rose. So you really do get the the fun aspect of the show without all of the, hey, look, here's 45 years of backstory we're trying to cram into your face before we get to the actual stuff.
It doesn't get exposition heavy.
Yeah.
In fact, most of the details that you get tangentially through other things going on. Like, they never really explain what the screwdriver is all about. He's just using it quite a bit, and it breaks, he gets another one, and you start to realize, okay, well, that's a tool of his that he utilizes. You know, the TARDIS is mentioned as a time machine, but that's about as far as it goes.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not even until, like, the last few seconds of the show that we actually get to see the inside.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's, this is a very, you know, I don't want to say encapsulated episode, but it's a great one-off of like, hey, here's, watch this show. If you don't like it, you know, end of story, you're done. It was a great, you know, hour-long ride. Yeah. But you've got to think though that Smith was following David Tennant. I mean, who really wants that job? Because that's really, I mean, that's like coming in after Tom Baker. That's just, I'm sorry. No, but I mean, really, he killed it. I mean, when you look at this and he sold the doctor, like, I didn't want to admit at the time because he was replacing my doctor. You know, no, you cannot be the doctor. You're not my doctor. So I didn't want to admit it then, but going back and looking at it now, it's like from the very first second that you see him, he sells the doctor. He really does. He becomes the doctor in this episode. And it's a really great portrayal.
Yeah. Haley, you're taking this. This was, you were a Smith first watcher, correct?
No, Smith was already on the air when I started, but I started at the very beginning on Netflix.
Okay. So did you do any jumping? I mean, as you were going through the Netflix queue, you didn't jump ahead to see what was currently airing?
I am physically incapable of doing things out of order.
Spoken like a true engineer.
We're lucky I didn't start in 1963.
Because
I almost did. But, you know, this was my first time seeing Smith as the doctor, and I bought him as soon as I saw him doing it. Like, I can understand why he is people's doctors. He's not my doctor, but I get why he would be.
You could see that he was, he took a lot of the, it wasn't a complete break from Tennantisms. There were a lot of aspects of that kind of caring concern and humor as a tension breaker kind of an aspect that Tennant had really exemplified.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd say that Tennant was more of a clear break from Eccleston as Smith was from Tennant.
Yeah.
But absolutely. It didn't take long for Smith to break off and really define his own doctor's identity.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's one thing that I love about this episode is you really do get that nice blend. And you get to see he did a good job of saying, okay, this is where the doctor's coming from. This is where he's going. This little bit in between, this is a mix of all that stuff. And it was a great, like, you did see shadows of things to come, and you did see a few holdovers that eventually faded. So, I mean, it was a great way to mix it up and help people to get into the new doctor without, you know, it's like, oh, transition, done, moving on.
Well, it did also show one of the highlights of what Smith really did with the doctor very well, which was the, you know, when things are at their thickest and chaos is all around, you realize that he's been in more control than you gave him credit for all along. He was really piecing things together. And, okay, here's where the needle drops. I'm going to tell you what I've been doing all along. You know, and I paid attention. I noticed this, this, and this. When you thought you had the upper hand here, I was actually two chess moves ahead of you here and here. You know, and then here comes the big finale and leads up to that. So, and I think, you know, and a lot of people have said, you know, oh, well, there's that moment, you know, and they're talking about the fact that what they love about this episode was the fact that they gave the tribute back in terms of that holographic projection as he goes up onto the roof of the hospital and has, you know, basically this verbal bitch slap of the Atraxis when, you know, and I Am the Doctor is playing in the background. You know, Gold is really like, he's kicked the crap out of the score for that scene and everything. And he's going up there and explaining, you know, the whole rundown of, you know, is this planet protected? Go ahead, search your files, see what you can find. There have been threats before, you know, many times before you, you know, and all of this is just building up. And he steps through, makes a simple announcement. Hello, I'm the Doctor. And people that were sitting in the room around me looked around and said, okay, I'll take it.
Yeah.
It works. And you look in the background, and Amy Pond has got this smirk on her face as he's just laying it down verbally and telling them that they can just, you know, jog on. And you could just think that, you know, as he's going through this whole explanation of what he's witnessed, why he cares about this planet, and the fact that this planet is under his protection, and that's a pretty formidable statement, and she's got that little smirk, you know that 90% of the viewers out there are going, hell yeah, and they're wearing the same smirk. So
yep.
That's when I knew that episode was one that was gonna hold strong. You know, if there's ever, you know, 20 years from now, you know, four regenerations from now, when they look back and they say, oh, we're going to boil down some of the best Smith episodes, this has to be on the list as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely. Yep. But then the next one that we've got on the list is another one that just sticks in your brain. We went with the Doctor's Wife. And this...
we went with the Doctor's Wife. Hello, nurse.
Yeah. No, so, I mean, this one... You know, obviously, when you've got Neil Gaiman writing an episode, it's a big deal. But this was a great look, not only at the TARDIS and Doctor's relationship, but at the Doctor himself. And, you know, I was watching through this again today, and it's just some of the things that you get out of this. I mean, Smith really runs the whole range of emotions. I mean, he goes from ecstatic to, you know, nervous to, you know, rage to utter desolation and everything, like three or four times throughout the episode. You know, and he's just, there's moments where, you know, he's on the verge of tears and then he starts laughing. He's like, well, that's a new experience for me. And it's just a complete, and he really, really gets it the entire time. I mean, I can't think of one time where I'm like, that was slightly out of character or that didn't fit. It's just everything he did was perfect.
I think, you know, this is just an emotion episode for a lot of people. You know, they lock into it because it's a really sadly beautiful episode. I mean, that goes without saying. You know, and the what I really love about what Smith brought to it in particular is the fact that you're taking an opportunity that none of his predecessors have had in terms of being able to really explore the relationship that he's had with his longest standing companion and being able to actually articulate that. And it's something that, since there is no precedent for it, that's a lot of pressure to put on the actor to get it right, so it doesn't become too either too hokey or too doe-eyed or anything that's going to somehow undermine the beauty and the sadness, the sort of the bittersweetness of what this script provides. And I think he's done a really exceptional job with that, so that when you do get to the moments where he has to step away from that and get business done, you know, the showdown with House and that sort of thing. It doesn't feel like you're watching two different episodes. You know, they stitch together rather well. He's able to transition well when he gets down to the, you know, I've killed dozens of Time Lords. Well, fear me, I've killed them all. You know, yeah. And he sells it like, oh, okay, that damn, all right,
yeah. That I think that line out of. I mean, there's so many great lines in this episode, but that one just sticks with you. Just, and a lot of that is because Smith's delivery is just completely deadpan. He's not really threatening. He's just stating a fact. And it's just like, this is something this guy has lived with for a long time.
They did that a number of opportunities with him. There have been a number of episodes where they give him those one quiet lines where he delivers them and the camera hangs for just a second so that he can just throw that out there, and it's just that really quick cut.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about it, Gaiman wrote this episode brilliantly. The dialogue is perfect, but... You know, I was watching it again today and thinking, you know, if you have someone who's never seen this episode and hand them a script with the exchange between the Doctor and Idris in the junkyard while they're building the TARDIS and say, hey, read this. Yes, the words are going to be perfect, but that's not what it is that sells that scene. The dialogue between Smith and Jones in this was just, isn't that like the episode one of series three?
Yeah, it was.
but, you know, that's what really makes you feel the emotions, you know, when the Doctor's, you know, yelling at her about never taking him where he wants to be and her just quiet, yes, but I've always taken you where you needed to be.
Yeah.
You know, and you really do begin to understand the relationship between these two that, you know, it has always been there, but we've never actually been able to put into context, basically.
if you're a Gaiman reader as well, I mean, if you've read any of his graphic novel series, whether it be Sandman or any of the others, or his novels for that matter, you can tell that he has that means of looking at things from just slightly left of center. You know, he takes a situation that you'd think you could predict the path of a conversation, you know, a dozen times over between two characters that you think you know very well, but he's able to put a spin on it that sort of catches you unprepared. It's just he's got that, what makes a really great fiction writer is the ability to be able to shift your perspective a little bit, and it really catches your attention because it's something you hadn't considered before. And this definitely does that. Well, Haley, you're a big graphic novel and comic reader. Have you gone through a lot of the other Gaiman series and things?
The only thing I've read by Gaiman is American Gods. I haven't read any of his comics yet.
Okay. If you get an opportunity, go grab Sandman. I mean, it's iconic. Everybody,
I have it. I just haven't read it yet.
Gotcha. You'll run through it rather quickly, but it's one of those odd slants that you start into it and you're like, I don't really follow where he's going with this one. And as soon as it clicks, holy crap! You know. So it's one of his gifts. Interesting to note, Jay, since you just mentioned the whole junkyard assembly scene. Mm-hmm. Were you aware that, I mean, I know that you guys, when we talked about the fact that the Blue Peter competition allowed the kids to create their own villain, and they did the whole, Absorbotron monster there. Did you know that the actual, they let the kids design a TARDIS interior back in 2009, and the winning submission from the 11 to 12 age category was actually used as the basis for what the two of them put together.
Yeah.
So go out and you can search. It's kind of cool to see her drawing alongside, what they actually ended up putting. She had things like hair curlers and jump ropes and a glue gun and all kinds of this crazy stuff on it. But it was that same idea of this, the mishmash that they assembled. But the time rotor looked pretty accurate to what she originally had drawn. I thought they did a nice job with that.
Yeah, and when you know that, going back and watching it, the moment where Idris picks up the little coat hanger and hangs it, just, while before it just seems kind of like, okay, yeah, why the hell not? When you see that, it's like, okay, I understand that now. That's like a little homage of here's a little thing that has no reason to be in here except for the fact that it's, based on this design. Mm-hmm. And it means a lot more at that moment.
Yeah, really cute. But you just got to note that when we're talking about the fact that he jumps all over as far as his emotional range and the fact that subsequent episodes back from when we had originally seen him to now we're into mid 2011 here, this is where he has one of those on-screen breakdowns that really, really tests the metal of your soul, because he's holding it tight, when he's explaining the house that, you got to be real careful what you allow back inside, because, she's able to kind of restore herself back into the console. And he's pouring a ton of emotion into it, and he's just barely holding it back. And you're thinking, wow, okay, that's nice restraint. That's really well done. But then when he finally actually has to say the hello that is their goodbye, and he does break down, sorry. Yeah. That's a soul check right there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If it doesn't get at least a little bit dusty in the room right there, you have no soul.
Yeah. Between that one and backing up when they do the I stole me, you stole, or I stole you and you stole me kind of conversation, those two right there are just some of the best writing the show has had in 20 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Then the last episode that we're taking a look at is Haley's pick this week, and that's A Good Man Goes to War.
Yes, I picked an episode where the doctor doesn't show up for the first 19 minutes.
And then disappears for 15 in the middle.
Yeah. I was sitting watching this again, getting ready for this, and I'm like, wait, the doctor's not showing up yet. Like, I'm ready to take notes. I've got my little pad, and I'm like, I don't have anything to write yet. It's been 12 minutes, and there's nothing on my page.
I kept looking down at the time signature at the bottom of the screen going, wait a second, I forgot. Was this a clip show? What did it do?
Yeah. I know. When I picked it, I'd forgotten that he wasn't in half of it. My bad.
No, but I think that works, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, the first 15 minutes of this do more to establish the mythos of the Doctor and show how the rest of the universe sees him. Because we always see him in that personal, like, we always see him through the eyes of the companion. We don't see the far-reaching effects of the Doctor. We don't see the legend that goes along with this traveling Time Lord. You know, we see him as the madman with the box. The rest of the universe sees him as they portray in the first 15 minutes of this. So it really does do a lot to set up the character as everyone else sees him, the part that we don't get to see normally.
I personally love all those aspects. Any time where you start to hear about him being referred to in the third person, or you get to see the impact that he's had on the farther reaches, you know, when they're saying, you know, talking about, you know, they've referred to him as the oncoming storm, the great scourge, the and that's where you think, damn, okay, then this is more than just, you know, as we see these goofy little adventures in this little spinny blue box, it has this lasting impact. And it makes you fully realize the fact that the extended universe, you know, both literal and figurative in this case, are far more impacted by his centuries of meddling or involvement.
Yeah. Oh, and then, you know, this episode does mark the one and only death that I can think of in the entire Moffat run or any of his previous episodes that sticks.
Yeah, maybe. Go ahead, nerds. Go out there and see if you can stick another one to it. No, we're not talking like off characters here.
Yeah, no, we're talking, you know, people that actually get a name.
Yeah, Unit Guard Number 6 doesn't count, or Headless.
But it happened in the same episode. It happened in the same episode as a character dying and then coming back later.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. So, but I mean, this is a great episode though, because you do get a lot of those aspects that we don't normally get, you know, and Matt Smith really sells the loss. Like, you know, as I mentioned, when Lorna dies, the Doctor's sitting right there talking to her, and you can tell the look on his face. He's like, I barely remember this girl. I was there for 60 seconds and we ran through a forest and now she's dying because of me. And like you feel that loss at that moment. You're like, oh my God, that is heart-wrenching.
So even if he's, you know, if his screen time only accounts for a third of the episode, because it's Moffat writing and this is an episode all about, you know, big energy, big emotion, big consequences, then you know that anytime he is on screen, it's going to be, you know, capital B, big business, you know, because he's got a lot that's going to come out, whether it's the sort of the sermon bits when he's in front of the assembled guards, or if it's the great emotional slash endearing moments with Amy and Rory, you know, as they're, you know, getting their baby back and such. I want my baby. Sorry. Or towards the end, you know, obviously the discussion over the cradle and everything, you know, he really gets some great stuff to work with.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's also an episode where we get to see a lot of the quiet anger that the Doctor just seethes sometimes.
Yeah, and sometimes not so quiet.
Well, that's just it. Which is more effective? The way Smith plays Angry Doctor, and we've seen Angry Doctor from so many. Mm-hmm. In fact, I don't think there's a single Doctor where we haven't had at least an opportunity to get some Angry Doctor out of him, and some were more successful than others. Smith has those two levels. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got the you know, that quiet, just barely above a whisper, go ahead, bring it, see what you can do, you know who I am, you know what I've done, you know, do you think you can stack up? And then there's the Sermon on the Mount, arms outstretched, the come on kind of Smith as well. Which one is the more memorable, or the more Smith?
You can't pick one. Honestly, I don't think you can, because they're both so effective. And that's one thing I will say about the writers, is they know when to put the, you know, which version. And Smith knows how to drag every ounce of emotion out of either one. You know, when it calls for that quiet moment, like, I mean, there's, you know, that, like we said earlier in The Doctor's Wife, that, you know, fear me, I've killed them all lines, you know, that those quiet little things stick in your head. And then obviously you can't forget the moments where he is, you know, screaming at the assembled hordes and, you know, challenging them to take him down. They're both so intrinsically part of this character that you really can't pick one over the other.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know. I think they've given Tennant had a quiet, angry Doctor as well.
Mm-hmm.
When he went big, I don't think it had the same impact as Smith did. I know that's unusual to say, but I think when it came out to the near rage mm-hmm. Doctor, I think Smith put something different into it than Tennant did.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that there's a bit of a switch there. You know, when Tennant would get the quiet angry, you'd see his face and you're like, oh, get out of the way, something's going to happen. But when he got like loud angry, you're like, okay, let me get my popcorn because this is going to be awesome. You know, you knew something awesome was going to happen. And with Smith, it's like, you know, he gets those quiet moments and you're like, oh, okay. But when he gets big like that, you're like, I'm going to take a couple steps back so I don't get the splash damage, because you knew that he was about to throw down.
Hmm. Yeah.
So. Yeah, I think that is a great difference between the two of them and their different portrayals of the anger. But we did get some great listener feedback this week. A lot of you did chime in and throw your episodes in, the ones that we need to remember. Actually, the first one that we got, we did get a voicemail from a listener, Bobby Honeycutt. So let's listen to that real quick.
Hello, this is Bobby Honeycutt. I was calling to say that I recommend A Christmas Carol for one of Matt Smith's top-notch performances. This was an episode where he had to deal with handling a child, getting the child right, handling a mean old miser, keeping a secret or not knowing the secret of a woman that was dying. And I felt like he went through the whole range of what the Doctor can be. A Christmas Carol is also an episode that would be good to introduce to someone that's new to Who, because it's an episode where you get to see the full range of what the Doctor can do. Travel in time and space, lobotomize someone, rewrite history. It's all right there. So I'm always confused why Christmas Carol is never in someone's top five as far as introducing someone to Who. And again, Matt Smith, 11 Doctor, I recommend A Christmas Carol.
All right. I think you may have been a victim of the 2-minute time limit there.
That's valid, though. I mean, I remember back in that episode, there were a lot of his exchanges back and forth with Sardik that really did a nice job. It was it showed his ability to be able to kind of that was another one where he got to sit there and show his kind of sleuth abilities, or not necessarily sleuth abilities, but one of those ones where you think he has less control than he does, and he's able to sort of show you
right,
you know, all along he's had this, and he sort of takes apart Sardik on that sort of thing, and the involvement with what was it, how you pronounce it, Kazrin again?
Yeah.
That's an absolutely valid choice. Yeah.
And I mean, it is great. You know, we always love the moments when they get the time travel right. You know, and the Doctor doing the jumping back and forth, and you know, bringing the kid to the present so that can be future, and it's a great way to play with the time travel aspect that we don't get to see nearly often enough, but I do have to say that this episode right here is probably the one that's responsible for me watching Doctor Who, because I had heard about the show a lot, and then I was listening to a podcast or something when they were talking about this. It was right after it aired, like the week or two after, and they at the very end of it they played the little sound clip that got me hooked, where you know he comes out of the chimney or out of the fireplace and you know says, oh, sorry, I was on the roof. It was Christmas Eve. I saw the chimney and my whole brain just went, what the hell? And that line was like, okay, this might be worth checking out. Mm. And the very next week I started watching it and have been hooked ever since. So I can completely support this being on the list of top five or top however many. But yeah, great episode. Then we've also got listener Brian Trent wrote in, said that, you know, the Doctor's wife, which we've already talked about, but he said, I feel like this was the best episode in the whole run and helps us and helps new fans understand the relationship between the Doctor and the TARDIS. And I mean, it really does. It there's no other episode you can point at that says, I understand the relationship between the Doctor and his TARDIS better than this one.
Yeah, I mean, you go through all the pet names that he has for her. You know, how many times for decades she was just old girl.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. And that was just, you kind of accepted that and you thought, all right, well, it's just, you know, sort of a term of endearment, like any captain does to his ship.
Yeah, I've had cars that fit that category.
Yeah, but even in this one, you know, as you go through all the pet names and things, it's still, and she even addresses that. You know, I love it when you call me that.
Yeah.
So.
And then we had listener Jamie at Closet Brit say the speech right before the Pandorica opens, the We're All Stories in the End speech, when Clara tells him about Trenzalore.
Oh, yeah.
And him begging Amy to stay in Angels Take Manhattan. And I mean, all four of those tremendously emotional scenes. Yeah, but especially we talked about that on the show when Clara tells him about Trenzalore and just the quiet, like, terror and complete helplessness that Smith is able to portray without even saying anything.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like he's been unplugged. He just collapses.
Yeah.
At the mention of it. It says so much.
Yeah. And then obviously the Angels Take Manhattan. Yes. Just completely destroyed anyone and everyone.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sitting there watching it, and my wife walks through the room, and she's like, are you sobbing?
No, shut up. I picked a hangnail.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, the We're All Stories in the End speech from the Big Bang is great. You know, when the doctor is, you know, saying his farewells, saying goodbye to little Amelia as she's sleeping in her bed. Yeah, that is one of those moments that really just helps to define the character of the Doctor. It's like, you know, when he's going to be trapped in the void, completely erased from history, basically, you know, and his one final wish is to tuck Amelia in and wish her the best and tell her this kind of thing. It's a great moment to really understand who he is.
Mm. But it's funny, they give Smith a couple of opportunities to be that sort of that bedside
mm-hmm.
caretaker. You know, he does it with Clara as well.
Yeah.
And it's just something about the way that he does that. They give him the voiceover, or whether it's something he's actually saying over the sleeping child or whoever, or whether it's done in a voiceover format. They loved giving him those opportunities to be the calming voice, the one to tell you that everything's going to be okay, or the one that tells you, you know, you're part of a much bigger thing, but every one of those little things is important to the big thing. Don't ever feel that you're small. You're actually much larger than you are. And, you know, and that sort of an approach. He just had an excellent way of being able to breathe life into those kind of moments.
Yeah. So let's take a look at some of those moments that, you know, really stand out. You know, obviously the one that everyone thinks of when you think Matt Smith giving a speech, the Pandorica. You know,
him come on!
Standing on top of Stonehenge, screaming at, you know, the assembled hordes of every villain he's ever faced, really. You know, and, you know, I've got no plan, no backup, no weapons. You know, I don't have anything to lose, though. Do you really want to take me on when I'm in this position? You know, that was such a great moment. And, it really sold the Doctor, too.
Mm. That's, again, it's one of those instances where a good writer who knows when to dip back into the strength that the show's history has. You don't have to reference everything. You don't have to say, you know, you over there, Centaurans, I, you know, kicked your ass back here, there, and the other place.
Yeah.
You over there, Cybermen, please, let's go back and break all those moments down. But he just gets to sit back and say, we've had our past.
Yeah.
I'm still here. I'm not going anywhere. Bring it.
Yeah. You know? And I mean, that last line in that speech, too, that, you know, remember every black day I stopped you and then do the smart thing. And then he just goes quiet and let somebody else try first.
Mic drop.
Yeah, exactly.
Doctor out.
But I mean, those are the moments that really help to define Smith's Doctor. You know, those are the moments when we look back at, you know, the 75th anniversary, we're going to be like, you know, the 11th Doctor was great for this reason. And this is one of those examples that we're going to bring up.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But then we've got some that are, yeah, I mean, obviously the next one that we think of when we think of the big emotional speeches was the Rings of Akaten. And I know Stargate Pioneer wanted to make sure that we included this. You know, he's always been an advocate for this episode, but, you know, that speech at the end, I mean, completely different tone, but still just filled with emotion. You know, and the same kind of thing where he's just, you know, look at all the things I've faced. You're draining my memories. Look at everything I've taken on. And you really think that you're going to be the one that's going to take that all away from me.
Yeah. I mean, this is, as far as I know, you know, no love lost in the episode, you know, with all respect to Stargate Pioneer and Soleil and some of the others who will carry the banner for this episode until the day that they die. Fine. I absolutely respect that. You can go ahead and have the rest of that episode. You know, you'll leave me this speech, 'cause even though it does get sort of undercut by the fact that he doesn't accomplish anything with it, but it's a great piece of writing.
Yes.
You know, and really deftly portrayed. It has, as far as you talk about, not only the angry doctor, but just the doctor that goes dark when thinking about all that he's been through, the weary doctor. This is that boiled down to the finest point. I mean, you know, talking about watching universes freeze and creations burn, and he's hitting every one of these accent points.
Oh yeah,
and you're feeling it in the chest. I mean, he's you see at a moment where you're not really watching him, even when he's on screen at the time, you're not even really watching him. You're looking back at the legacy of all that he's been through.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's those moments where the light is shined, is pointed very clearly at all of the negatives that he's faced. You know, we think of this as one of those go off, have your adventure, and win the day. There's a lot of that negative space in between that drives him, that defines him, that we don't dwell on because it would make for a really freaking sad show.
Yeah.
But it has its weight.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, it has to vent and hope to gods that you're not the one in a path when he has to vent.
Yeah. And I mean, some of the things that, you know, I've heard it said that the first doctor was an old man playing a young man trying to be old, but was really just, you know, a rebellious teenager. And then, you know, Matt Smith is basically a young guy trying to play an old man who's pretending to be young and energetic, but is really old and tired and has too much, you know, on his plate. And it really is a great thing because both of those really do fit, but this is the scene that really does help you believe that, you know, this is a doctor who has lived for over a millennia, who has seen far more than any living creature should have to endure. And, you know, all credit to Matt Smith for being able to put that kind of emotion in there.
While probably in front of a green screen.
Yeah. And you
talked right to the tennis ball.
Ooh, you tennis ball, you son of a bitch.
Did they paint a little pumpkin face on the tennis ball?
A little angry pumpkin head.
No, they swapped out the tennis ball for one of those little mini Halloween pumpkins that you get.
Yeah. Well, it did look at times like Jack from Nightmare Before Christmas, so maybe they had a few of those laying around.
Charlie Brown in the background. It's the Great Pumpkin. But you know, the great speeches are absolutely fantastic. But the ones that really stick with you too are the moments where he becomes a very personal character. You know, when he understands the emotions of a person and really reaches out to them. You know, that an episode that we don't normally go back to was, you know, the God Complex. But there's a moment at the end when he's telling Amy that, you know, she needs to forget about him, that he's no hero, and, you know, explaining to her, you know, I stole your childhood and I've led you by your hand to your death. You know, and just saying, you know, you're the one that is the hero in all of this. I'm not the one. I really am just a madman in a box. And, you know, the last line that he tells her is, you know, Amy Williams, it's time to stop waiting. And those are the moments where you're just like, oh, okay, chills.
Mm-hmm. But it was absolutely necessary for the moment. Mm-hmm. You know, in what it was a, you know, take it for what you will. If you did or didn't like the whole idea of the Minotaur that was feeding off of, I mean, the God Complex is one of those episodes where people either, you know, got it or just didn't get it, didn't want to get it, sort of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
This had all kinds of breadcrumbs of interesting aspects with every door that opened and that kind of thing. But that whole idea of this thing that feeds off of, or this enemy that feeds off of that faith or that trust, and if he can shatter that, if he can just shake that foundation, a very foundation that he's been trying to build because of the fact that he cares so much about the Pawns, wants that family,
yeah,
and he actually has to come up with the words to rattle that, it's going to hurt.
Yeah.
It has to hurt.
Absolutely. And I mean, that it's great because you see all of the walls come down. You see the doctor completely bare. You know, all of the bravado is gone. All of the, you know, the joking and the, look at me, I'm the Time Lord. And I'm the, you know, everything that he uses to build up his character is stripped away at that moment. And he's like, this is who I am. I'm not someone you need to look up to. And it's a rare glimpse into the character of the doctor. You know, then some of the other ones that we've got in, you know, Closing Time, when he's talking to the baby. Yeah, I love that scene where, you know, just the exchange between the two of them, and, or, well, you know, Matt Smith basically monologuing, but Yeah,
I'm sure the writing for Stormy was brilliant.
Oh, probably, yeah. But you know, then when he's tucking him in, and you know, talking about, you know, all the stars, and you know, talking about himself when he was a boy. You know, it's like, you know, I wanted to see the stars when I was your age. You know, that's why I do what I do. And yeah, you know, it is just a great moment of a quiet recollection that, you know, he doesn't let people see that side of him. He really doesn't.
They didn't give Smith's doctor a lot of opportunities to wax historical about life on Gallifrey. They really gave so much of that to Tennant. Really didn't give Smith a lot of opportunity to do that sort of or even in passing mention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you do get those moments, it is very touching. But, and then obviously if we want to talk about emotional episodes, you can't avoid Vincent and the Doctor. And you know, the end where they're coming to Amy has to come to terms with the fact that they didn't save Vincent, that, you know, he still wound up killing himself. And the Doctor, like, look, no, it wasn't a useless gesture. You know, the whole pile of good and bad things that he goes into is, you know, that's always one of those things. When something bad happens in my life, I'm like, okay, good pile, bad pile. One doesn't negate the other. I'm going to get through this. Yeah. And it is just a great little bit of dialogue and, you know, great little speech that it doesn't have to be one of those great Sermon on the Mounts, but it still carries so much weight to it.
Yeah, it's just like we were saying, the bedside doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Smith does an excellent job of being a consolation. He's very adept at being able to talk people through things.
Yeah. So, I mean, all in all, I've got to say, you know, Smith was just a tremendous doctor. And, you know, I might not call him my doctor, but that's not saying that he wasn't absolutely fantastic. So we do have some news this week, a little bit anyway. So apparently Foxes is going to join Series 8 and have a musical number as well.
Okay.
Yeah, not quite sure what to do with this information.
Okay. I'll step up first and just say I don't really know who Foxes. I know she's Grammy Award winning. I'm sure she's pretty popular. I don't know who she is, so feel free, folks, go ahead and send me samples or whatever. I'll be more than happy to listen to. I thought this was literally going to be the had to do with that whole "What does the fox say" thing.
Oh God,
I didn't know.
Yeah.
So, and then I was concerned that it was going to turn into sort of a Buffy thing where they have like a musical artist of the week sort of thing appear and do a number.
Yeah. And I don't think that it's that. I mean, she's come out and said, you know, she feels like, you know, she was very excited to do this and she's been wanting to get into acting for a while. And she's like, what better place than such an iconic show like this? And it all comes across like she is a fan of the show and she wanted to be in the show for the sake of being in it. And it all just happened to work out right. And so I don't know. We'll see what happens when it comes out, but I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
But in terms of music though, one thing that a lot of people have been able to enjoy over the past week and a half or so, was the Hillywood, spoof video that was done that, not only did we all fall in love with seeing them, portray a number of characters, going through, Rocky Horror's Time Warp, but also got the attention of BBC proper. So they got a job well done, kind of kudos, from the folks upstairs.
Awesome. Yeah, a lot of fun. Just, you know, even if you've never seen Rocky Horror Picture, you've heard the song. I can guarantee you that much. So it's fun just to go and see the different ways that they bring all these characters to life in this little short video. But speaking of videos, we did get a interesting first look of Capaldi in action, kind of.
Yeah, another link in the chain that shows that if you ever did an open source or crowd funded, crowd produced, fan assembled program, there's an immense amount of talent out there.
Yeah,
you know, from the teaser trailers that we used to see, or the what was it just last year when the guy did the opening credits.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what he thought it would look like under the Capaldi era. And it was just one of those things where for the first couple days it was out, people were like, whoa, is this really it? Because the production quality was just through the roof.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen people talk about this. They're like, it looks you know, it looks real enough to be fake, but it looks just too fake to be real. And it's just, what am I looking at here? You know, and so the video that we're talking about is Rain, and you can find the link in our show notes. Go to gallifreypublicradio.com/89 and find it right there. But this video is just it's a short little thing of, you know, Capaldi's doctor walking out of the TARDIS onto a Rain planet, and then, you know, holding out his hand for Claire to come with him. And it's just brilliant. The faces are a little bit like, what kind of thing?
Yeah, it's a little blurred. It's a little whitewashed, a little overexposed intentionally. It sort of has that feel. And I think that's because obviously from where they were gathering some of the footage from to try to get the right angles and stuff. But did anybody else get the feel that this felt like the intro sequence when you turn on like a Final Fantasy game? And everything was bright whites and purples.
Kind of, yeah.
And faces coming out of the mist kind of thing.
A little bit, yeah.
That's what I took from it. I'm like, oh, this is like if Squaresoft wrote the trailer to...
But this is actually from the same guy who did the little video Stone that came out a month or two ago. I know we posted it on the website. I don't know if we ever talked about it on the show, but the little video of the guy in the alleyway with the flashlight and the weeping angels after him.
Mm-hmm. You know, it was raining there too.
Yeah. I mean, just tremendous graphical capabilities. But, you know, both of these videos are just like, I sit there and I'm like, I'm looking at it like, wow, I'm going to give up on my career right now because there's just no way that I'm ever going to get there because these are just fantastic. But
it's got a good emotional sell to it.
Yeah. Then we've got some more promises from Stephen Moffat. Apparently, I prefaced that. I said promises from Stephen Moffat, so
take it for what it's worth.
Yeah,
No, but he basically came out at a recent festival. Was it like the Hay Festival? I think, and just basically said, well, you know, we're not going to follow a formula. And if I was going to cast another bright-eyed, you know, dashing young guy into the role, people would say, oh, you're following the same old formula you've done for the last three gentlemen since 2005, and this isn't going to be any different. How much of a mix-up could you possibly do? And he's, well, here's a guy in his 60s. Ha-ha! Change! Suck it! So if that's the best he's got, and that's all he's going to say at this point, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, this is just more hyperbole from Stephen Moffat. We've gotten to the point where we're used to this. It's like, okay, yes, talk it up all you want. Make all the promises that you want, whatever. Not every answer came in the Christmas special. We know your game. Just, you know, we'll watch the show when it comes out. Thanks for giving us a headline in the meantime. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
we've had a lot of friends who have said, you know what, I'm tapping out from all of the news between now and then. I don't want to know anything more about what you think or isn't going to think or don't think is going to happen. I don't care anymore. Talk to me in August. You know, let's talk about something else. Bye.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can completely respect that. That's, you know, sometimes I really feel like I wish I could do that. Then
somebody tweets something. And
exactly. It's that fresh revelation of, oh my God. What is this one? The Double Clicks covered the Doctor Who theme on cellos.
Yes, I just came across this through, I think it was a tweet from the Mary Sue that they had latched onto it. And Double Clicks are basically just two cello artists or two string artists that do all kinds of interesting stuff. They wrote an Agent Coulson theme a couple weeks ago, and they're pretty prolific. They actually post a YouTube video at least every other day. So they put out a lot of material, and it's really cool. It's just, this one happens to be a three-track overlay of cello, just doing about the first minute of the main theme, but it just has that nice deep resonance to it. It sounds really cool. For those of you out there who are string aficionados, and I know we do have a number of listeners who, the moment you hear a cello or any other string instrument being warmed up, they, you know, their ears kind of pop up and they sort of push other people aside so they can hear what's going on. This is definitely worth it.
Yeah, absolutely. It is nice just to get that, because the editing, just, you know, playing one person playing three different parts is really cool.
Yeah.
And it just sounds awesome. But
it does.
Oh, and then the last bit of news that we got, the Doctor Who magazine came out with the top episodes ever of all time. And this is a revised version of the Mighty 200 that we've talked about before. And this is everything up through the Day of the Doctor.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's just interesting to see where a lot of these fall. And they included the ranks from the previous the Mighty 200 list and like where they were and where they are now kind of thing. You know, you've got stuff like the 11th Hour making its appearance at number 17. You know, that's a new one. Then you've got stuff like Human Nature and Family of Blood was in, you know, number 9th spot, you know, up from number 6. Okay. Or down from number 6, I apologize. But it's just kind of interesting to see where these fall. And I mean, obviously, I'm not going to run through all 241 episodes. That's, yeah. If you want that, go buy the magazine. That's what it's there for.
Yes, yes.
But the top 10 we will go through here. So 10, we've got Remembrance of the Daleks. 9 is Human Nature and the Family of Blood. 8 is Pyramids of Mars. Understand that one. 7 is The Empty Child and the Doctor Dances. 6 being The Talons of Wang Chang. I know I pronounced that wrong. Sorry. 5 is City of Death. 4 is The Caves of Androzani, which was previously the number 1 spot. So that dropped a couple spots. Genesis of the Daleks is up to number 4 or number 3, which actually stayed in number 3. Blink stayed as number 2, and then the new number 1 episode ever of all time. Can I get any guesses? Anybody?
Doctor's Wife.
Kier?
No, I'd probably go with that as well.
The Day of the Doctor.
Ah.
Of all time? All time?
Well, these are fan voted. Let's put that out there. But yeah, it was 92.06% of fans. I'm not sure how they figured out the totals. But then Blink was 91.87. So it's... I mean, but I respect it. It was tremendous. I can say yes. It definitely belongs in one of the, you know, way up there spots.
Yeah, top 15, maybe even top 10. Well, you got to bear in mind that this is from people that are contributing their votes at this point.
Yeah.
As opposed to 41 episodes ago or 41 stories ago when you had a different voter base.
Yeah,
essentially.
Very different. Because I mean, this was the top 200 was really before the American popularity hit its stride. You know, you had Whovians over here, but they weren't as prolific as they are now. Mm. And a lot of these people, like we said before, came in the Smith era. So, it makes sense. Well, I just found the Doctor's Wife is actually at 37. That's way lower than I'd expect.
Yeah.
But, I mean, a lot of these stayed in their same spots, though. I mean, obviously some shifted around because you're adding 41 new episodes, or 41 new titles, at least. But I don't know. It's an interesting list to go look. And they've got it broken down by decades, too, where, you know, you look at, okay, here's the 60s. Here's the top 10 episodes from the 60s. Here's the top 10 from the 70s. So it's just kind of interesting to see where everything falls in and, you know, how they did the numbering and things like that.
It's not a bad reference point to use if you've gotten a sort of a smattering of exposure to previous Doctors and you think you've kind of got a feel for, all right, I see how Pertwee really differed from Davison and that sort of thing, or you know, and you start to get that kind of established, and now you want to see, okay, I hit what what GPR or what this other list said were the number one or two episodes from each of these Doctors. Now I want to dig a little deeper into it. This isn't a bad way to go about it.
Yeah,
because this is that sort of that meta review from a wide fan base. This isn't just a bunch of, you know, bloggers and things like that telling you what you really should watch, or, you know, blowhard pundits like us telling you what to watch. Yeah. But it's, I think, speaking just in terms of going back to the earlier eras, if this is a modern voting result that still incorporates so many of what you want to call, big finger quote, is classic Who, still on the list there in some of those top slots, then don't take our word for it. There's a reason why, even now with all of this new material, these older episodes still rank so highly. So,
yeah. Well, they've actually got a spot for favorite Doctor, too. This is kind of interesting. So, number 1, Tom Baker, with 21.69%.
Yep.
Take a guess at 2 and 3.
It's not Tennant and Smith.
Oh, it is Tennant Smith, separated by 0.06%.
Wow.
Matt Smith at number 2 with 15.57, and David Tennant at number 3 with 15.49. Hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, very, very close. But the surprising entry in this one is number 12, John Hurt, with 0.68%.
I love Grant.
Lower than Colin Baker. So, hey, Colin Baker, you're finally not the last spot.
Nice job. Way to recover there, Sixie.
Oh, and then favorite companions, obviously Sarah Jane hitting the number one spot. Donna Noble at number two.
That's good to see.
Yeah, with 10.62%. Then Rose Tyler, then Jamie at number four. Jamie above Amy, who's in number five.
Well,
I mean, you can't.
Once you get an opportunity to really see some of the interplay that Jamie and Troughton had and the fun that they had with their roles together, yeah. you can see that.
Yeah, you really can't go wrong. But Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart at number 12.
12. God, well, come on, people.
Okay, how many people were looking at this and thinking, okay, which ones are actually companions? Because I wouldn't have thought to put Brig in there. I really wouldn't. So there might have been a lot of people thinking the way that I did. So I don't know. True. But then Tegan at number 15 at the bottom of the list. Right below Rory.
Perry did not make the list.
No, she did not. Not even in the top 15. Man. Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot more rankings and stuff in here too. So you can get Doctor Who magazine on the iOS digital version, which, I mean, that's what I did. I saw the headline. And I was like, oh, I might want to pick that up. And I got it this afternoon. I've been looking through it ever since. So, you know, it's very easy to get here in the States now, as long as you don't mind a digital version. I know you can still get the physical version, but it's a bit expensive and takes some time to get here. So,
At least a week and a half delay to get it sent over. Sometimes even up to 3 weeks or so before you get a hard copy.
Yeah. But, you know, it's definitely worth it. They cram a lot of stuff in there. And there's a piece with Stephen Moffat in there talking about Series 8. So definitely, you know, if you want to start digging into the nitty gritty, that's a great place to start. Yep. So, but that's about all the news that we've got this week. So next week, now that we're done with our Doctor's Introspective, we're going to start taking a look at some of these episodes to get people talking. And we've discussed this a little bit before. I know Kira and I have, but the fact that, you know, Moffat has a hard time killing people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's so funny that I think it was just this morning or just overnight last night, somebody was tweeting around talking about, oh, I love Clara Oswald and blah, blah, blah. And when is Stephen Moffat going to stop killing off characters?
I think the correct phrase is, when is he going to start killing off characters?
It was like, did you have him confused with Joss Whedon? Did you have him confused with J.R.R. Martin? Did you have him confused with, you know, run down the list of writers and showrunners that just will get you, you know, locked into a character and then say, you know what, I'm done giving you this character now. But let's put that out there for folks to either defend or correct us on whether or not Moffat has the ability to really steal a character away from you.
Yeah, because I mean, like we pointed out earlier, I think that Lorna is the only episode or only person in a Stephen Moffat penned episode, or even in his run as showrunner for most of it, that, you know, didn't somehow wind up getting, you know, miraculously brought back to life by, you know, universe reset button, or hey, that episode never really happened, or hey, you were dreaming the whole time, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can find others, please let us know and defend this, because I would love to be proven wrong and be like, you know what, okay, he does have the cojones to kill people off occasionally, but I don't see it, so please chime in. This has been episode 89 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, I will always remember when the Doctor was me.
This is Kira saying, oh, come on then, sexy.
And this is Haley saying, words.
We'll see you guys next week.
You said it.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows by calling 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1477 to leave us a voicemail. You can head to GallifreyPublicRadio.com to leave comments on each episode. There you can also keep up to date on all the latest news and gossip, as well as what's going on in the community. Also make sure to head over to GunnaGeek.com to find out lots of other high-quality, geek-centered shows. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.
Ma'am. Wow. She qualifies as a ma'am.
Yeah, I grew up with this little thing called manners, you know.
Yeah.
I know they don't have those up there, but down here in Texas, you know, that's currency.
Haley, sup?
But until next week, yeah.
J Professional.